From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's not every week that a protest creates an international incident, but here we are.
The Pentagon is now preparing options after President Trump signed a proclamation directing the National Guard to be deployed to the U.S.-Mexican border.
The move to mobilize came after several days of tweets in which the president focused his rage on a group of Central American migrants who have gathered to travel through Mexico. Many are seeking asylum there. Some are planning to seek asylum in the United States, and a few are planning to cross the border illegally.
Now, the caravan, which is over 1,000 people coming in from Honduras, thought they were going to just walk right through Mexico and right through the border.
On Thursday, after 5 days of tweeting about it, Trump said the caravan was largely broken up.
No, it's not.
Carrie Kahn is NPR's correspondent for Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean.
I spent all day Wednesday with them, and there are hundreds of men, women, and a lot of children, many sick now, if I can add that, in this park. It's a recreational field with soccer fields and a couple, you know, swing sets and stuff, in this small town in southern Oaxaca State. And they're still there, and they're united front, and they're going to continue traveling north. Just how far north together this group will travel is very much unclear and in flux.
So the group's still together. Earlier this week, the president said that Mexico was not doing enough. On Thursday, he declared that Mexico's government was in control. Its strong immigration laws, better than ours, he said, had stalled the caravan.
No, the strong Mexican migration laws did not break it up either. Mexico does not have strong migration laws. It has porous borders, underfunded resources, and they're unable to deal with this group of migrants, too, because every year, tens of thousands of Central Americans trek through Mexico on their way to the U.S. border.
This week, Trump also returned to a theme of his campaign, that immigrants from the South prominently featured rapists.
And remember my opening remarks at Trump Tower when I opened. Everybody said, oh, he was so tough. And I used the word rape. And yesterday it came out where this journey coming up, women are raped at levels that nobody's ever seen before.
Migrant on migrant crime? No. And this group is incredibly united to stay together as a group and to provide safety for a lot of the women and the children that are traveling alone.
Trump also was demonstrably wrong in depicting the so-called caravan as somehow unusual, a threat to national security.
Well, first of all, the word caravan is sort of a misnomer. And I think that the word that they used to describe this is I've had a hard time to translate it and find a proper translation. It's called Via Crucis.
Atentamente, Caravana 2018, Via Crucis, Migrantes en la Lucha, Pueblos y Fronteras.
And it's sort of a religious pilgrimage, hinted sort of way. And I think in the translation, it sounds like everybody's in these cars when you think of caravan. No, it's not. It's just a group of people that have come together. Mexico has a long tradition of pilgrimages and long marches.
This particular caravan started in Tapachula, Mexico, just across the river from Guatemala, where many migrants from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador wait in shelters to make the journey north.
It wasn't that they all came en masse from Central America. I think that's very important to point out. And they're traveling on their own. They get to Tapachula, Mexico. The caravan organizers say, hey, come with us. Let's all travel in a big group. And people want to do that. I heard from people, especially the women traveling on their own with children, that they feel safer.
There are many so-called caravans in Mexico, some lasting only a few hours. Their purpose is twofold. First, there's safety in numbers, safety from gang violence and robbery, and safety from immigration officers and corrupt government officials. But it's also a form of activism, making those who are invisible visible. One of the best-known caravans is an annual 4,000-kilometer trip by a group of mothers whose migrant sons and daughters have disappeared. Alberto Xicotencatl is the director of Migrant House, a shelter in Saltillo in northern Mexico.
Ellas muestran fotografías de sus hijos desaparecidos.
They show photos of their disappeared children. They meet with officials and they demand a search for the disappeared and protections for migrants, because if there were protections, their children wouldn't have disappeared. They wouldn't have had to move around in the shadows hiding.
Shiko Tenkatl says that Migrant House doesn't organize these group journeys because they can't guarantee the traveler's safety. But Pueblos Sin Fronteras, People Without Borders, who organized this week's trek, has done several. Alex Mensing is a project coordinator.
Last year, Pueblos Sin Fronteras helped coordinate two caravans in which asylum seekers traveled all the way from the southern Mexico border to the northern Mexico border, where they presented themselves at an official port of entry, turned themselves into U.S. immigration authorities, and requested asylum.
So how did this particular caravan come to the attention of Trump? The path is as well-worn as the Stations of the Cross. First, BuzzFeed ran a story with the unfortunate headline, "A huge caravan of Central Americans is headed for the U.S. and no one in Mexico dares to stop them." Breitbart and then other right-wing sites soon picked it up. Then, as usual, it got to Fox and Friends. Mensing says it was probably the BuzzFeed headline that hooked them.
Yeah, I do think that the way the headline of the BuzzFeed article, the first one that came out, was written galvanized the right more than it galvanized the left.
We talked about this this group of migrants, 1,200, marching to America, and the BuzzFeed reporter that's going along with them reporting on it. They're marching to the U.S. border because they want in and they want to make a statement with a reporter touting what they're doing.
And less than an hour later...
Well, President Trump on an anti-immigrant rant on Easter Sunday, much of it on Twitter. Here are the tweets. Border Patrol agents are not allowed to properly do their job at the border. Getting more dangerous. Caravans coming. Republicans must go to nuclear option to pass tough laws now. No more DACA deal.
Tucker Carlson, meanwhile, took the opportunity to express disapproval at an activist who blamed U.S. policy for the event.
U.S. should be more welcoming.
So our sins,
much
our
more
sins are the reason
the
this is. So you hate America,
very, very
is what you're saying.
Of, very big
I don't
part
know
of
why. Actually, it's interesting.
Sins.
You're blaming America for illegal immigration into America.
The coverage and rhetoric has gotten so intense that even Brandon Darby, who covers immigration for Breitbart, tweeted, quote, "I'm seeing a lot of right-wing media cover this as people coming illegally or as illegal aliens. That is incorrect. They are coming to a port of entry and requesting refugee status. That is legal." And he elaborated on Breitbart News Tonight with a pointed, if peculiar, simile.
The organizers of this group are actually pulling something similar to what Dr. Kevorkian did. This is something that happens all the time, just like assisted suicide, you know, when it comes to overdosing people on giving them too much morphine and they slowly pass away. This happened all the time, but then came Dr. Kevorkian and put it in everyone's face, and then all of a sudden there's legislation and people looking at the issue. And so this group, People Without Borders, is actually doing a favor to the right. They're shooting themselves in the foot because it's something that happens all the time. And by highlighting it as they're doing it, it's only going to highlight the need for congressional action on this issue.
This caravan was much larger than the organizers were expecting, and they can't continue on the route as planned. But if the goal was to shine a light on what migrants are experiencing and the conditions in Honduras forcing them to flee, then Mensing considers the news coverage a win. NPR's Carrie Kahn says that if that was the goal, the media in large part haven't done their part.
The vast number of those people in that group are suffering from incredible levels of violence and incredible levels of just difficult situation in their countries that we have not really talked about much in the press.
She said she stopped to talk to a woman sitting by a stream.
She was actually putting on makeup, trying to make the best of a terrible situation. She was with her two daughters, one's 15 and one's 11. They live in Honduras. And her daughter, 15-year-old, was kidnapped by gang members for 2 days and gang raped. This happened 4 months ago, and her daughter is just traumatized. And then when she tried to do something about it, she was confronted by the gang and threatened with her life, and she didn't know what to do.
She says she'll probably try and seek asylum in Mexico. Meanwhile, Mensing and other organizers have gotten death threats. And he thinks it's because of the hysterical coverage generated north of the border. Now they're rethinking future projects.
It's definitely a factor in deciding to not try to do a large public event at the border, even if that large public event, as there were last year, is designed to highlight a completely legal access to asylum.
And Alberto Xicotencatl of Shelter House in Saltillo says that the caravan story has already sparked more violence against migrants in the north.
Hemos recibido desde ayer y hoy hombres y mujeres golpeados.
Between yesterday and today, we have received men and women who have been beaten by immigration officials who were trying to detain them. They have bloody head wounds. This had not happened like this until the international incident of the President of the United States making claims that in Mexico there was no detention.
As for the migrants in the caravan further south, the Mexican government has given many of them 20 and 30-day permits to travel around the country without deportation. Against the backdrop of Mexico's presidential campaign, this has been a tense episode for officials. NPR's Carrie Kahn.
I do think that the spotlight that President Trump put on this group provoked the Mexican government to work as fast as they did, because to get these visas or these travel permits, 20 to 30-day permits, is very difficult. But they came to this big group of people and issued them within a day or two, which is amazing. I had met some people that had been in Tapachula, Chiapas, there at the border waiting for these permits for months, even years. We'll have to see how many of those people actually try to ask for asylum, whether those pictures and images of hundreds and hundreds of people walking has swayed a public opinion in the United States or lawmakers' opinions. We'll have to see on the negative side of that.
This is a story spawned by an unfortunate headline and thoroughly misreported by Fox News, which famously has the president's ear. It's a textbook example of a case where facts were obscured by fantasy, where the usual is exaggerated beyond reckoning, putting the lives of people who are already terribly vulnerable at risk. It's the kind of thing we've become accustomed to. And that may be the scariest thing about it. Coming up, sex trafficking on the internet is a tragically difficult problem. But then again, so are the seemingly simple solutions.
I think that what's happened with these bills is really indicative of something bigger. It is where the people most impacted by this bill were written out of the conversation and became the collateral damage of good intentions.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. In our editorial meeting this week, we found ourselves, as we often do, smashing headlong into the complexities of a story. And this time we coined a term to describe it. It was a brainer, as in the opposite of a no-brainer. For instance, doing anything you can to try to put an end to the horror of child sex trafficking, that's a no-brainer. Some websites make despicable bank by selling children as sex slaves, as depicted in the chilling 2017 documentary, I Am Jane Doe.
Well, the most popular internet site for escorts is called Backpage.com, where authorities say underage girls are sold for sex.
Backpage is the Walmart of human trafficking. It's an incredibly profitable business.
We will never be the family we were before she was sold on that website.
We need someone to give us a fighting chance.
I Am Jane Doe spurred a national awakening, first in the media.
In 2016, the National Human Trafficking Hotline counted 5,500 sex trafficking cases. Now, of those, 1,379 involved juveniles. So think about that for a moment.
Then, in Hollywood, engaging such celebrities as Seth Meyers and Amy Schumer.
It can no longer be legal to advertise children for sex, period.
This is the dark side of technology.
That campaign culminated last month in legislation when two bipartisan bills, SESTA, the Senate's Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act of 2017, and its House equivalent, FOSTA, the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, sailed through Congress. It was a real no-brainer.
Congress clearly said, we want to protect the young people in our country, many of whom are doped, kidnapped, forced, beaten into sex slavery.
Democrat Carolyn Maloney is the co-sponsor of the bill and co-chair and co-founder of the House Human Trafficking Caucus.
This is really transformational legislation, and I believe historic, and will literally save lives.
It cleared away the legal roadblocks that for too long had shielded trafficking sites.
We passed two incredible bills that allowed victims and their families to sue the back pages of the world that were selling their children online.
But this is where things become a bit more of a brainer, because SESTA FOSTA weakens the core provision of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, Section 230, which protected digital platforms from being sued for the illegal speech of their users, thus enabling the internet to innovate and thrive.
It's definitely made a huge difference in making the internet a place where people can communicate with each other and share ideas with each other.
Elliot Harmon works at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
For example, the company that runs your email service, or the company that provides you space to host your website, or a social media platform like Twitter and Facebook. Section 230 says that if you say something in one of those spaces that is unlawful, then it's you who should be held responsible for that and not the platform itself.
Section 230 is why Twitter doesn't have to pre-approve every tweet, why Wikipedia can exist at all. This story is a brainer because it's Section 230 that has mucked up lawsuits against sex trafficking websites like Backpage, Representative Carolyn Maloney.
The internet should not be used to help foster crimes. Oftentimes, the crimes are the cruelest on the youngest in our society. I mean, I have talked to people who came to this country to, quote, work in a hotel where they took their passports, tore them up, and threw them in a basement where they were used as sex slaves until they figured out how to escape. I am thrilled with this transformative, historic legislation, which will give law enforcement the tools that they're asking for to enforce the law, and really giving a protection to families and young people that have been exploited and abused beyond any human belief.
And while the bill hasn't yet reached the president's desk, the tech industry has begun to shiver in anticipation of the death of Section 230.
Looking to make a love connection? Why you won't be able to find it tonight on Craigslist.
Craigslist taking down its personal site. I think that that's a pretty good example of the risks that we're talking about here.
EFF's Elliot Harmon.
When this massive increase in liability essentially forces platforms to kind of put their thumb on the scale and err on the side of more censorship, it's not going to be a matter of removing specific posts. It's going to be a matter of removing entire websites and entire sections of websites. The increase in liability essentially takes the kind of moderation that should be a scalpel and turns it into a hammer.
And is that because many websites, or most of them, don't have the ability to automatically filter in a scalpel-like way? Congress is asking them to develop that kind of technology, but what exists is not good enough, at least not yet.
Yes, you're completely right. There's this saying that was actually coined by a tech journalist named Mike Masnick, nerd harder. And the nerd harder problem, that's whenever Congress thinks that it can affect a huge improvement in technology by passing laws requiring technologists to make those massive improvements in technology. Most of the time, it doesn't work.
Which means that sites are cutting off access or shuttering altogether, rather than contend with the liability they might face if they miss something illegal. Especially the smaller sites that can't afford the human monitors or lawyers that could keep them afloat.
Everyone is not silenced equally. The people who get the short end of the stick, as it were, is people who are marginalized in other parts of public life, too.
Congresswoman Maloney doesn't see it that way.
WordPress.com reports of commercial sex-related advertising sites removed. Google reports of publicly shared commercial sex-related advertising deleted. Reddit, new policies banning sale of sex acts and drugs. Verify Him, advertising newsreel gone. Night Shift shut down to review policies. The Erotic Review, Yelp of the sex trade, where men rate their experiences with trafficking victims. U.S. boards were shut down, and City Vibe shut down, full shutdown. I'd say this is all great.
But Harmon says that along with the ads and the scurrilous message boards, there are those that share valuable information that enable isolated, vulnerable groups to share experiences, like the internet always has, along with all the awful stuff. That's how the internet was designed, intentionally. And he says that with different rules, it could have been as conglomerated as traditional media. It could be like cable TV.
When you look at it in retrospect, it's easy to think of it all as having a kind of air of inevitability to it. The internet being this awesome place where people can gather and talk with each other and even sometimes talk with each other about controversial things. It is, in fact, just as easy to imagine the internet without these protections and an internet in which only the very largest corporations can play, and an internet that instead of being this amazing place where we can communicate and share ideas with each other and fall in love with each other, instead being much more one-directional.
Harmon says that Sesta Fosta endangers free speech. Kate Diadamo, an advocate for sex workers and sex trafficking victims, says it actually threatens people's lives.
What this does is actually just drive the sex trade underground, and that includes everyone in the sex trade, regardless of their circumstances, and that includes trafficking victims. It forces people to trade sex into other venues, including street-based work, including brothel-based work, making people more vulnerable to exploitation, but also to violence and to HIV and STI transmission. Also, when you make an entire community that much more precarious, it gets a lot harder to do things like enforce your boundaries. This bill didn't come with anything that addresses why people are exploited. But what it did was push people into areas and venues where they're more likely to be exploited.
It bans illegal activity. If it's illegal, it is banned from the internet.
Congresswoman Maloney says the bill is expressly concerned with the lives of trafficking victims, not those of adult sex workers. But Diadamo says that being forced into the shadows hurts everyone.
Yeah. The internet brought much more visibility. If you were being trafficked on the internet, you are much more identifiable to law enforcement, to outreach officers, even to family members. If you have to move to a brothel or a massage parlor, it's going to be much more difficult to not only identify them, but to figure out how to access that person and then how to do post-conviction work.
What do you think people actually imagine, though, Kate? I mean, the people who pushed this bill through, they're imagining a nightmare scenario, but one that does exist, where people are tricked into coming into this country from somewhere else. They're underage. Maybe they've been sold by their parents. And they're, you know, left in a room until their services are needed. And they are already isolated.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're completely right. I'm never going to impugn the intentions of the people that passed this bill.
I think that nuancing our understanding of these situations is a cornerstone of more effective anti-trafficking work. Because the story that is in most people's heads is often not reflective of even most people in trafficking situations. If we actually empowered sex workers to be able to discuss best practices, that means you're empowering the people who are vulnerable to trafficking and the people closest to trafficking victims.
Diadamo says that the internet is an easy target, but the root causes of trafficking require a different kind of solution.
Trafficking is absolutely a crime that preys on vulnerability. If we want to say, you know, is this going up or going down, we have to look at things like, what is poverty right now? What's happening to people who are migrating? What does it mean to access living wage labor? Because we know what the root causes are. And if we want to address trafficking, we actually have to address those. The services available to people identified as survivors is an embarrassment. Very often, I'm talking to service providers who say, I did everything for this client, and they're still supporting a family of six on a $10 an hour job. There are bills sitting in Congress right now that actually would address improvement of services, expansion of training, addressing the convictions that people come away with after leaving many of these situations, and they're stalled. They're not moving.
We're certainly trying.
Congresswoman Maloney.
It is incredibly difficult to pass legislation that costs money now with a almost $20 trillion debt. But we're trying. We have 50 beds that I know of that are funded now.
SESTA FOSTA, which costs almost nothing, no increase in funding for beds for trafficking victims or for law enforcement or for homelessness, is a comparatively light lift that, to its backers, seems like a simple way to undermine the child sex trafficking marketplace by sending more of the guilty to jail.
It is the most profitable crime. It's more profitable than selling arms or selling drugs, and you can sell the human body over and over and over again until they die. So this bill is really going after the Johns and the pimps and the traffickers who exploit young people for their financial benefit.
And the lack of beds means that they could wind up right back in it.
I've heard terrible stories where young girls have escaped. They have absolutely no place to go. And they end up in some stranger's home. They just have no place to go.
And some have suggested that SESTA FOSTA will make it harder to find them and the people who exploit them. Here's Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, who co-authored Provision 230.
I fear it will send these evil people who traffic beyond the grasp of law enforcement to the shadowy corners of the dark web, a place where everyday search engines don't go. And it's going to be even easier for criminals to find a safe haven for their extraordinarily evil acts.
Well, I would say that 50 attorney generals across the country disagree because they all wrote to Congress in support of this bill.
Another brainer. The bill could make it easier to jail perpetrators, and it could make it harder to find them.
I think that what's happened with these bills is really indicative of something bigger. It is where the people most impacted by this bill were written out of the conversation and became the collateral damage of good intentions.
Ridding the world of sex trafficking is something on which we can all agree. But the best intentions can lead to unexpected outcomes. A plan to help some may harm others, usually the people we tend to look past, perhaps because to see them would be to see how ill-equipped we are to root out a problem we'd much rather strike out with the stroke of a pen. It's a brainer, all right. Moments before we were posting this episode, we learned that the website Backpage.com and affiliated sites was taken down and seized by federal law enforcement authorities. Coming up, is Martin Luther King, as a model of masculinity for young black men, past his prime?
The image of King as a moral authority has been wielded against black youth in all subsequent generations since his assassination.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Wednesday marked the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. He died just days after joining sanitation workers in Memphis who were demanding living wages. This was a year after King's call for an end to the Vietnam War, 4 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, and 3 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. 10 years earlier, when he was still in his 20s, Martin Luther King Jr. was a prominent preacher, an activist, a family man, and also an advice columnist for Ebony magazine. Writer Michael Denzel Smith, exploring the legacy of King as a role model of black masculinity for Atlantic magazine, found that readers asked the civil rights leader for advice about everything from race relations to marriage problems, and that the exchanges revealed as much about King as his readers.
There are people writing in to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. asking for typical advice column stuff about their relationships.
They're like messages preserved in amber from the 50s. I'm going to read one of these letters. My husband is having an affair with a woman in our housing project. He promised to stop, but he's still seeing her. We have children, and I don't believe in divorce, but I cannot and will not share him. What must I do? And part of King's advice reads, since the other person is so near, you might study her and see what she does for your husband that you might not be doing. Do you spend too much time with the children in the house and not pay attention to him? Are you careful with your grooming? Do you nag? Now, let me correct myself. This isn't preserved in amber from the 50s. This is preserved in amber from the 1890s.
To be as fair as possible to Dr. King, there are a couple men who do write into him asking for relationship advice, and his first reaction is to advise self-analysis. The problem I see here, though, is he gives lots of advice that is drawing on these sexist ideas about who women should be and what housewives should be, and ignoring any ideas around gendered labor that happens to exist. He's asking, do you spend too much time with the children? Where are the children supposed to go? Dr. King doesn't seem to think about this, right?
With, as you note, some exceptions. For instance, birth control.
This is true. Someone wrote in asking him whether or not he considered birth control sinful. And King says that he does not consider it sinful and that women should not be just breeding machines. And so he does have some understanding of women as people who can make their own choices and make their own decisions. But the advice that he gives to a woman who says that her husband's a terror, and he's just like, well, have you asked yourself about yourself lately? What have you done to produce this behavior in him? That he doesn't extend that thoughtfulness about birth control and about women's rights and about women's autonomy to this relationship advice seems maybe as like writing himself his own pass, right? Knowing what we know about King and his own philandering to say, it is not my own fault.
So why did you begin your column with the advertisement from Jet and the column from Ebony?
He had been on the national scene for all of 2 years at this point. And Ebony has called him in as a 28, 29-year-old preacher to help you with happier living. We have no reason to believe that Dr. King can help anyone with happier living. He reveals here that maybe he wasn't exactly prepared for it. But there is this idea of him as someone of high moral character.
60 years later, it's still the same.
60 years later, it is exactly the same. And the image of King as a moral authority has been wielded against black youth in all subsequent generations since his assassination.
You call it a shaming tool.
Yes. I often describe the civil rights generation of the 50s and 60s as analogous to the immediate post-World War II period, the greatest generation, the 50s and 60s are the greatest black generation, mm-hmm. right? We look to them as the perfection of what black America could be. And Dr. King stands above them all. We want to say that if you are not living up to the example of King, then he must have died in vain. Mm-hmm. And so all social ills that are a product of institutional failures and oppression in Black America get translated into moral failures, character flaws.
And here are some of the problems with this formulation, as you describe. One is that part of why King was able to connect beyond the black community into the white community is because he adopted white cultural stuff.
There are cultural mores that would define one as respectable. For men, you dress in a suit. You have a level of education. You come from or have achieved a middle class status. You have a respectable profession. And you sound the part. King obviously had that very preacherly Southern drawl and could draw upon that when necessary, but also he was able to speak in ways that could make people forget he was black. He represents the right kind of black manhood, the one that would open up the White House doors. What that then gets read as is it is the product solely of King's respectable presentation that we are able to enjoy the fruits of the civil rights movement. Now, that's certainly part of it. The leaders of that movement were some of the more quote-unquote respectable members of black communities, right? I mean, this is where the dichotomy gets set up between King and Malcolm X, right? Like, the Nation of Islam mm-hmm. very proudly drew their membership from those who had been in prison, those who were on the streets, those who were hustlers, those who were involved in prostitution, sex work. If you look at them, they look very similar in
do.
Their presentation,
one
right?
had a bow tie, one had a straight tie.
Very, very similar, but different backgrounds. Malcolm X does not have a high school degree, did not go to college. He went to prison for 7 years. And so many members of the Nation of Islam are drawn out of those very prisons and ghettos that would have otherwise been discarded as members of society that are disposable. There is also a difference in who what we would call like the mainstream civil rights movement, who is involved in that. These are church-going folks. The black middle class, for the most part. Part of what makes it so outrageous that people would be treated this way is because they were the right kind of
right.
people.
In your article, you mentioned a 2006 episode of The Boondocks, produced by a black illustrator,
yeah.
in which Dr. King wakes up from a coma four mm-hmm. decades after a failed assassination attempt, and what he finds are black people, you say, generally being uncouth in a way that King, cartoon or real, would disapprove of.
What is imagined that he would disapprove mm-hmm. of, right? Like, the ultimate King moment of this episode is him standing in front of a sea of black people who are partying in his honor. They're blasting music, they're dancing, they're drinking, they're having fun. Some people are getting in fights and all of this. And now Aaron Magruder's vision of King comes to address them and says,
"Will you, please shut the hell up?"
He just said what I think he said.
"Is this it? This is what I got all those ass whoopings for? I had a dream once. It was a dream that little black boys and little black girls would drink from the river of prosperity, freed from the thirst of oppression. But lo and behold, some four decades later, what have I found but a bunch of trifling, shiftless, good-for-nothing—"
Here's an imagined King, who we know as a political actor, who spoke forcefully around the ideas of white supremacy, of militarism, of capitalism. We know this King. What Aaron Magruder imagines him coming back to say to black people is that you have failed because of this deviant behavior that you're participating in.
And you wrote that what happens is that the holy status that he has in black and white culture presents an obstacle to the examination of systems. It isn't his choice of suit that made the impression, but his political savvy, his tactics.
Yeah, you don't win the Voting Rights Act just because you put on a suit. You do it because you coordinate many different actions over a course of years, facing the violence and using the media to shame America into producing some semblance of justice in the form of legal action. That's not solely because King was a religious man who believed in a divine order and was married and had children. Those are accomplishments of a man, but those are not political tactics. They helped, but you have to ask to what extent. Those civil rights and voting acts of the time period have been easily chipped away at. This is not to knock how monumental those victories are, but if all that you're fighting on is the principles of respectability, you can fight for the right to vote because respectable people should have the right to vote. But does that change the way we view felon voting rights?
What about these challenges to black masculinity today? If we're just talking about a style that was a style in the 60s, it kind of reminds me of the Hasidic people in Brooklyn who walk around in clothes from the 19th century. Is that what's happening here? Well, or are there more specific challenges than just clothing?
It's not just clothing, but the clothing is representative of something. King is a very specific mode of operating as a black man that we've come to believe as the most successful version of what a black man could be. And what kind of masculinity does King represent? Not just the respectable suit and tie, preacher, religious, all of that, but he is a cisgender hetero man, right?
Right.
And so you're sending a message to anyone that is not that, that you are a failure of black manhood. We can talk about King being a father, but also he spent a lot of time away from his family and his children because he was committed to the struggle. There are just so many disconnects between who King actually was and then the idealized version of him that are used to then prescribe a certain sense of black masculinity that all the rest of us are supposed to live up to.
And I can't think of an analogous person in the white community.
No one's like, if you're not George Washington, you are a failure, right? Only King is used in such a way to chastise black youth. There have been real political consequences. You can go back into the 1980s and 1990s. Credit where credit is due, civil rights leaders of that period were calling for things other than policing and incarceration. But they also used the rhetoric of failing to live up to King's dream to chastise black youth who were involved in violent crimes and then the drug trade, and then turned around and used that same rhetoric of failure to live up to King's dream in imposing the draconian laws that turn into mass incarceration.
The same people?
Same people. Eric Holder, as Attorney General of Washington, D.C. at the time, he delivers an MLK Day speech where he's talking about black-on-black violence, the failure of our people to live up to that example.
And where kids who have not yet reached their teenage years already have sworn allegiance to a life of violence and a life of crime. I am dissatisfied that in Washington today, more than 2,500 young people are active gang members. So yes, like Dr. King, and like many of you, I am dissatisfied.
He has the ability to then enforce laws that stop black motorists in the pursuit of the drug trade and illegal weapons. He's turned the police and the state on black folks in the name of King.
Just before King's assassination in 1968, you note he participated in a sanitation workers' strike in Memphis. And part of what set off this strike was two sanitation workers getting mashed up in a trash compactor. And it just seemed so inhuman, like they didn't care.
The striking workers held up a sign saying, "I am a man."
That I am a man, then we was going to demand to have the same dignity and the same courtesy any other citizen of Memphis has.
We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are saying that we are God's children.
These signs would mean something different in 2018?
Yeah. So when we're looking at it now through this lens, we're looking at people who think being a man is tied to their economic futures because they've been taught that a man is the head of household and that part of the rights that are being denied to them are not just the rights of being a worker who makes a living wage, but the rights of a man to make a fair wage and provide for his family. So when we're talking about examining these moments and trying to tease out what's useful and what's not, we have to divorce the very real rights that they were fighting for from the way in which they understood those rights, and that being so closely tied to their rights as men. And this is drawn from a lot of King's writing as well. He couched these rights very much in a masculine framework that Black folks were and poor folks were being denied the dignity of manhood. The Black man has been denied, and the Black man has been subject to, and the Black man this, and the Black man has seen his woman degraded. And, you know,
yeah.
It's just this idea that the worst aspects of what racism does is deny men the right to be men. There are a number of different things to just like unpack there. Racism, one, affects Black women as well, right? But then also, what does being a man mean? What are the rights that you think are being denied to you? And are what you perceive as rights not oppressive to someone else?
So, if the image of King has been misused, that we've deflected our focus not just from the systems that are responsible for endemic racism, but even from his own strategies and tactics that enabled him through relentless effort to make some change in the society, and that it's oppressive to young people today. Mm-hmm. What do you propose?
I am okay with taking a vacation from King. I mean, across the board, everyone. Every now and then we like have a discourse around King and what King really meant and who King really was and the radical King, and we need to rescue his image. But I think that he's too far gone at this point. It can be too overbearing and oppressive and not productive to continue to labor over arguing King's meaning. I think we can take a break from King.
And you said across the board. So
across the
white
board,
community should
everyone,
really give King a break as well. You're not saying we should stop recognizing him once a year on the holiday, are you?
Maybe for a little while.
What?
Maybe for a little while. Maybe we need to let go completely for a little while. I don't think that it's productive. The holiday has been turned into this day of service. It's like, go to a homeless shelter and feed people. That's mm-hmm. not the same thing as transforming a system so that there are no homeless people and there are no people that can't afford food. I'm saying maybe we do just need to let go of him for a time to discuss the future of our politics without drawing upon him to inform it.
How long?
15, 20 years.
How about masculinity? You think we should put that aside,
we
too?
We should get rid of that, too.
Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Denzel Smith is the author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Micah Loewinger, and Leah Fetter. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Philip Yiannopoulos, and Isaac Napel. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. And by the way, why don't you sign up for our newsletter? It has more of everything you love about On the Media, and it's written by our brilliant producers. Just go to onthemedia.org. Bob Garfield will be back next week, I promise. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.